From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Faltering Citigroup may need more government assistance, edging it closer to the realm of nationalization. And the stimulus funds will soon begin to trickle down to the states, though the president insists that oversight will be strict.
Let me be clear, though. This is not a blank check.
Still, some GOP governors plan to snub at least some portion of their allotted stimulus funds. Here to help us sort out the economic news of the day, we've got Keith Reed. You can find his wisdom online at Keith Reed's Money Corner. Keith, nice to talk to you.
I'm doing all right. How are you, Tony?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Last week, the market actually improved a little bit, but now stocks are seeing a downturn amid talk of this bank nationalization. Much of the financial system, that is, has been hit pretty hard, in particular Bank of America and Citigroup, as you know. And this week, an important measurement begins, the so-called stress tests for banks to determine their solvency. There's so much to attack here, Keith. Let's begin with this whole concept of the government easing the terms of its investments involving preferred versus common stock. What is the impact of that move?
Well, the impact of that is basically with the government transitioning to a common stock model. What they're basically doing is putting themselves in a position of being shareholders, and therefore they're not the banks don't have to pay them back first. When you are preferred, when you hold preferred shares or any type of subordinated debt, you become essentially the first creditor that an institution, a publicly traded institution, has to pay back. Okay, when you're a common shareholder, they don't have to pay you back because you're in an ownership position. So you're not in the position where they have to automatically, where the bank is under pressure to pay you back for the money that you lent it or the money that you invested. That relieves some of the pressure off the banks, which already have, as you know, many, many troubled assets, and the assets are the pot from which they'd have to pay back any investors or any lenders.
Well, let me ask you.
So that's the idea behind it.
Let me ask you this then, Keith. We've heard the word nationalization quite a bit lately. Are these steps, are they something that would lead us closer to nationalization in your view, or the kind of steps that would prevent us from getting closer to nationalization?
I think it's sort of a hybrid, and what it does is it definitely dilutes the private ownership of the bank. In the case of Citigroup, I think the figure that I read was that as much of, as 40% of Citigroup's shares could be held by the government. That would obviously dilute much of the private ownership of the bank itself. That takes us in the direction of nationalization, but not really. The idea here is that if the government owns some portion or some percentage of the bank, that makes it easier for the government to make some of the kinds of decisions that it needs to in terms of getting some of these bad assets off the bank's books, and then they could turn around and sell their shares back on the open market. So you take it to a public ownership or to a national model, clean up the books, and then you turn around and sell it. And that's exactly what happened with Washington Mutual at the end of last year when that bank was taken over.
Now, this week, the Treasury is going to begin to administer what's called a stress test. This begins on Wednesday for the 20 or so major banks still in operation. I'm assuming, Keith, that this is the litmus test to determine whether or not nationalization really has to be on the table.
That's exactly right. One of the things that worries a lot of people is that the results of the tests aren't expected to be made public. But you're exactly right that these quote unquote stress tests are exactly that. They're a litmus test. What the government is going to do is go in, take a look at the bank's books and figure out whether they could survive one more round. In other words, if something else went bad, if another thing went wrong, how many of these banks would fail? And those that fail, you might start to see the government go in the direction of buying up more shares, or even shutting them down, taking them to a nationalized model, at least for the time being. We don't know what the results, obviously, of those tests will be, or what exactly the government will do in the event that they don't hold up under the scrutiny of a stress test, and we may not know until long after, because we don't know they're going to make those results public.
A couple of things are happening as a result of the government's effort to try to shore up the banks. So number one, in terms of Citigroup, for example, shareholders are dumping their shares, and the price of Citigroup has really tanked. That's one thing. Another thing that's happening, other people are trying to avoid U.S. banks altogether. And in fact, the Department of Justice is urging a tax probe of Swiss banks because the feds want the names of 52,000 Americans, apparently, who are using these banks secretively. Are they going to be able to get that information?
They may be able to get it, but they're arguing right now. At the end of last week, UBS was supposed to turn over these records. UBS balked at that and said that we're not giving up those records. So there's sort of a stalemate in there, and they're arguing about this right now. This is essentially a case of this is the proverbial Swiss bank account. When you hear that joke, then, I sent all my money over to Switzerland so that I don't have to pay taxes. The government is saying that's exactly what 52,000 or as many as 52,000 Americans did by creating accounts with UBS, which is a Swiss bank, and that UBS very nakedly, very blatantly covered up what it was doing and taking these deposits from Americans and created these code words. A nut was supposed to represent something like $100,000 or $250,000. A swan was $1 million. A sea was $100,000. You know, these code words that they were using really to conceal the identities and how much money people were hiding at that bank and basically hiding that money from the IRS.
At the same time that some people are trying to hide, there are others who are trying to get their hands on money coming out of the government. The governors of the states met with the president today, some of them saying that they're going to take that money and some of them are not. I want to talk specifically, though, about one portion of the stimulus package that affects states and local governments and has to do with education. President Obama's package has allocated $100 billion for public schools and colleges. This is nearly double the amount the Bush administration allocated for the Department of Education's budget over a two-year period. Do we know how this money is supposed to be used as it relates to education?
Well, we can say anecdotal. We know that Arne Duncan, the new education secretary, came from Chicago, where he was CEO of the schools. In Chicago, he was very big on teacher qualification. He was very, very big on teacher quality, very big on getting better teachers into urban schools. Very big on raising academic standards, switching from your basic standardized testing, and you're already starting to see some states talk about doing things in that direction. If you look here in Ohio, Governor Strickland rolled out a plan in January. That plan is very, very close to what Arne Duncan is talking about, in that he wants a longer time for teachers to be trained before they get certification or before they get tenure. He's talking about getting rid of the Ohio graduation test. He wants a different measure for students coming out of high school. He wants all of these various things that relate to teacher quality, that relate to reforming education in the ways that the Obama administration would probably like to see it done. So you're going to start to see plans like this, I think, around the country, with an eye towards obviously getting hold of some of this $100 billion, because that will be the litmus test. How close are you coming on these goals? And if you're coming close to these goals, then you can get a piece of this money.
A number of the governors today told the president that they are, and before today actually, that they don't want all of the money because either they were opposed to the stimulus package along ideological lines, or they think that the money in the case of Mississippi and in the case of Louisiana it provides for unemployment in a way that they say will bankrupt the state down the line. But my question is, I don't hear any of these governors saying that they don't want the money as it relates to education. I can't think of a circumstance under which a governor would do that, can you?
No, and I honestly can't think of a case under which any governor will ultimately turn down the money. I think when the deal goes down, and this money starts getting released, that you won't see many governors. I don't know that there's a state in the union right now that's in a position to be able to turn down the federal dollars for what it needs. I think what this is a lot of political posturing. If you take, for example, we've got a Representative Boehner, who's from here in Ohio, one of the top Republicans on the House side. He's come out and been very critical of the money that's going in for high-speed rail that was announced last week. I think it's about $8 billion. And he came out and did a lot of grandstanding about high-speed rail. And, you know, we can't spend all that money, and it's going to be for Sin City Express from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, when the reality is that money is not allocated for a train line to Las Vegas. And in reality, right here in Ohio, we've got a plan on the table right now to bring high-speed rail linking Cincinnati, which is part of parts of which are in his district, to Columbus, the state capital, all the way up to Cleveland. I don't think that that if some of that $8 billion, for example, comes to Ohio, that Representative Boehner is going to say no, we don't want this train, because it does help some people who are in his district or who are close to his district. I think it's a lot of political grandstanding on the part of some of the House Republicans who didn't support the stimulus package as it was written to begin with.
Our time is out. Let me just circle back really quickly to ask you a simple yes or no question. Do you think that the banks will ultimately be nationalized, or do you think that's not going to happen?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. I think, again, that we will see something of maybe a hybrid structure. Maybe some of these banks, if they become insolvent or get too close to insolvent, that the government might take some significant ownership, but I don't think that will be a lasting structure in the U.S.
All right.
National banks.
We've got to stop there. Keith, thank you very much. Our money guru, Keith Reed.
Thanks, Tony.
This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We just heard how the stimulus package will give money to schools, but not all schools can wait for the federal money. Some schools are cutting the school week to 4 days a week to save money. A school in the small town of Oak Ridge, Oregon, is one of those schools. And in a few moments, we will talk to a parent of one of the students there. But first, joining us now is Donald Kordosky. He is the superintendent of the Oak Ridge School in Oregon. Mr. Kordosky, welcome.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Your school will start having a 4-day school week soon. How did you and the school board decide, and why did you decide to shorten the school week?
Well, we were looking at ways to improve academic achievement, and that's how this started. We looked at some other school districts in Oregon that use the 4-day school week, went and did some site visits and decided it was a good fit for us, and then went through the process of having parent meetings, community meetings, subcommittees, and all that sort of thing.
So this was a proactive decision that you thought would improve the school, not something that you did out of financial constraints.
Absolutely. We are a small school district. We have a declining enrollment. We've lost over 40% of our enrollment in the last 10 years. We were looking at ways to improve the quality of education for the kids in Oak Ridge, and the 4-day school week seemed to be the best way to do that. It had absolutely nothing to do with money.
So how is going to school 4 days better than going to school 5 days, and how does it help a student learn?
Okay, well, first off, what we did was we looked at all of the research, including meta-analysis from 1980 on, for every dissertation and academic journal article. What we found out is that the 4-day school week increases student attendance, it decreases teacher absences, it increases employee morale, teacher turnover decreases, and it improves student academic progress. So when we looked at all of those things, we looked at the negative connotations that, you know, naturally come with thinking about a 4-day school week, did our research, and found that it would be a good fit for our kids.
How many hours a day are kids in
school? They're going to be going to school they start at 8 in the morning and finish at 3:36.
And what were they doing before that?
Going from 8:15 until 3:15.
Now, what are parents supposed to do with their kids? This is for kindergarten through 12th grade?
That's correct.
And what do parents do with children about childcare on Friday when
school's closed? Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because even though we're on a 5-day school week right now, in reality, we are not on a 5-day school week. There are 21 weeks in the school year where we have 5 weeks out of 38. However, there are also 7 weeks where there's only 4 days of school, 3 weeks where there's only 3.5, 3 where there's 3, and 3 where there's only 2.5 days of school. Right now, the parents are having to find childcare half days on Thursday for teacher work days, teacher in services, grading days, conference makeup days. All of those days will be removed from the schedule. So there'll be 4 days of school each and every week. One of the ways that we're looking to help with the child care situation is that we're training all of our students, all of the high school and junior high students, to be certified through first aid through Red Cross for child care certification. And then parents will have that as a pool to find child care. Also, the research shows that for the most part, although it's a perceived problem with the four-day school week, that in reality, the fifth day, they always do find child care, either through family or through babysitters.
Final thing is this, and I appreciate your coming on. How many kids are we talking about?
Total in the district?
Yes.
And we have 595.
All right. I appreciate you coming on, sir. Good luck.
All right. Thank you.
That was Donald Kordosky, who was superintendent of the Oak Ridge School in Oregon. Now we turn to Carol Miller. She is a parent of an Oak Ridge student. Hi, Carol.
Hi. How are you?
So I'm fine. How are you? That's the question.
Well, I'm good.
I mean, with this 4 day.
I support it. Like Don said, the kids were already on such a sporadic schedule, and I'm a stay-at-home mom, so it didn't affect me specifically, but there were so many parents that were agitated with this schedule on a regular basis that this is just going to bring consistency to most people's lives.
What do the kids say?
The children I've spoke to, the older kids are for it. The younger kids I don't really think are that aware as of yet. My daughter is for it. She's also in sports after school 3 days a week, so this will give us 1 day of relaxation when she does have the sports. And she's an advanced learner, so the fact that it will be able, hopefully in time, that she'll be able to go at her level instead of being held back as she is now in some ways, that's the advantage I see of it.
Is she in high school?
She is in elementary school. She's in third grade and currently is in the seventh grade reading level.
Now, we talked to you. You support it. We talked to the superintendent. He supports it. But are there those in the district, parents, who do not support it?
There were several community meetings. There were several opportunities for parents, community members to come and voice their opinions. Some people showed up. A lot of people didn't that had the opportunity to. And I'm sure once this goes into effect, there will be people come forward that maybe aren't happy with it. But the opportunity was there to express their concerns.
What about?
And it is on a 2-year trial.
All right.
And so, you know, the kids will have time to get used to it. The parents will have time to get used to it. But I really think it's just going to be way more consistent because this was ridiculous, the schedule before.
What are the teachers saying about it? They like the idea?
Most of them are in support. There were very few that weren't, and their concern was with the reading program adapting to the new schedule. And they're working on that.
One of the things that seemed obvious to us here at News and Notes with regard to this is the issue of Fridays and what to do with students on Fridays. You heard the superintendent talk about youngsters being trained in CPR and Red Cross and first aid as a means of potential, I don't want to say babysitting, but a means of support on Friday. Do you buy that? You like that idea?
Like I said, I'm a stay-at-home mom. That won't be an issue I'll have to deal with. But personally, you know, I would rather see an older person watching my children if I were at work all day. But there's a lot of people here with relatives. There are a lot of child care providers. I really don't think it'll be that big of a problem. And like I said, the schedule was very inconsistent before, and they were having to deal with it then.
And this was not something, as the superintendent said, that was brought about because of a financial crisis.
No, initially it was brought about because this school has a lot of Title I children, low-income children with some learning disabilities, and there's also a lot of children that have high learning capability that aren't being addressed. And even though there's money in the system for TAG, it isn't there. And these kids who need the extra attention aren't able to advance the way they need to, and it's almost like we're kind of settling and, you know, focusing on the lower level and instead of encouraging the kids, you know, that have a lot of talent and knowledge to excel. And so we're really hoping that this program will just, you know, raise the standards of the school, in fact.
All right. Well, Carol, good luck with it.
Okay. Thank you.
That was Carol Miller, a parent of a student in Oak Ridge, Oregon. The Oak Ridge, Oregon school system notwithstanding, schools in many small towns are struggling with the economy, and colleges and universities across the country are also seeing reduced endowments and smaller donations. Historically, black colleges and universities are being hit especially hard. Plus, during a bad economy, the question arises whether or not it's even worth it to go to college, and affordable as well. The Academy Awards were held last night. Another story we're going to tackle. Two African-American actresses were nominated, but neither took home an award. What does this mean for black actors and actresses in Hollywood? Joining me to discuss all of these issues on our Bloggers Roundtable today are Sean King of the blog Sean in the City, Sharon Toomer, founder and managing editor of blackandbrownnews.com, and Anthony Bradley, who blogs at The Institute. Hello, everybody.
Hey, hello. Tony. Good morning.
Hi, Tony.
Hey,
good,
nice to have you all. We just heard how a small town school district is shifting things to try to improve the education. But let's talk about historically black colleges for a moment, where they're trying to improve education as well, but the economy is really hitting them hard. Sharon, your alma mater, Spelman, one of the wealthiest historically black colleges, mm-hmm. had to eliminate 35 staff jobs, and it's projecting a $4.8 million deficit. That's not good news.
It's bad, bad news. And you're right. We're one of the Spelman's one of the fortunate college, historically black colleges and universities, and that we have a healthy endowment. But you're not supposed to tap into your endowment to for operating expenses. And so it just goes to tell you that none of these schools, I don't care how wealthy they are or how prestigious they are immune from this economic climate. And that's always been the case with HBCUs. It's not just as a result of this economic climate we're in. It has always been the case, the survival of these schools.
Well, Anthony, who is supposed to support these HBCUs? Is it the students? Is it the community? Is it the government? Is it the corporations who recruit them for jobs? Who's supposed to put their money into these campuses?
That's a great question, Tony. I would argue that all those parties have a role to play. The fact of the matter is that if we look at the economics, many HBCUs are simply more expensive than the community college. For example, here in St. Louis, Harris Stowe is about $164 per credit hour, and St. Louis Community College is $83 per credit mm-hmm. hour. And so a lot of students are having to make a decision about whether or not having a unique black experience at the collegiate level is worth the money. Also, we find that a lot of universities are too dependent on tuition dollars to cover their operating budgets. And development departments, I would argue, need to think more creatively about bringing in different revenue streams so that they can make that experience affordable.
You know, that's an interesting point, Sean, that he makes, because going to an HBCU, certainly to a Spelman or to a Morehouse, and I imagine to a Howard as well, they're not cheap by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I hear you, man. And I'm a graduate of Morehouse College. And
well, then you
all
know.
The schools,
you
yeah,
know what
all
I'm
the
saying.
Schools, yeah, all the schools here in Atlanta are really struggling, particularly Clark Atlanta really had to shake up their entire schedule. And it's right. The schools are so, even Morehouse and Spelman and Howard and FAMU are so reliant upon tuition. Like at Clark Atlanta this semester, hundreds of students, almost 400 students, surprisingly, didn't come back for the spring semester. And the school was just shocked. And so they had to totally rework the schedule. And it's kind of the thing that people say, when America gets a cold, black folk get a flu. And that really affects black colleges in a major way. And so I'm thinking a few black colleges may close during this recession, or may come together with traditional or predominantly white universities. They're considering that in here in Georgia in Savannah, but it's tough. It's definitely having a major impact on the schools.
Well, certainly it's happening in other places with universities that may not be HBCUs. Here in California, there are none, but there are schools that are predominant. The population is predominantly minority, and they are beginning to coalition with larger, more financially stable universities. Sharon, my last question on this topic to you is, what can be done, do you think? What is the best thing that we need to do to try to keep these schools going?
Well, first, Tony, I have to say this, that Atlanta and the consortium there is a very unique situation. We've got the oldest and largest consortium of historically black colleges and universities. They were responsible for, and I'm not just touting numbers, this is just, I've been saying this for many, many years. They were once responsible for producing 75% of our black middle class. So along with alumni involvement and seeing these universities as critical to our community and the education of our students, I would like to see corporate, philanthropic, former students, alumni, And the general community, meaning the Atlantic community, although I hear Atlanta's just like everybody else, is just not doing well. So I think it's a collective effort to ensure that, like, Morris Brown should not have its water shut off. I understand they have some budget issues. You know, they've got some management issues. They always have. But to have our schools go without water should be unacceptable.
Anthony, let's talk about you for a moment, because you are currently in graduate school. Is that correct?
I actually recently graduated in the last year or so.
Well, here's the issue. I want you to speak to it. The cost of going to school, whether it's an HBCU or a majority white school, set that aside for a second. How difficult a decision is it for young people now, looking at what it does cost to go and the loans that they have to accrue? How much sense does it make to put yourself in that kind of debt now to get a degree or an advanced degree?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been as the reality of my loan repayments hit me, I began to question whether or not it was worth it. And looking back, of course, everything depends on what one believes the purpose of education is. If the purpose of going to college and grad school is just to make money, it is actually not worth it, because you can go to tech school and learn how to do some computer stuff and make a lot of money. However, if the point of your education is to broaden your learning, that is to be in a community of teachers and scholars, to experience your own learning and to discover other areas of knowledge, then it is worth it. And it's really a matter of weighing the cost of essentially mortgaging your education over 30 years to pay it off.
Well, Sean, does it make sense during tough economic times to maybe place college on hold to save money for college instead of taking out expensive loans by going now?
No, I don't think that makes sense at all, man, because, one, the cost of tuition and the cost of attending college is going to continue to rise, and so it's not like it's going to be cheaper 4 or 5 years from now. And for a lot of students, being able to live on campus in a kind of safe, secure environment, it's much more stable than taking a risk and trying to find a job in the job market. I'm with you. I understand that some students, as always, need to kind of consider some alternative paths, but I think if there was ever a great time to make sure students are enrolled in college, it's right now. I mean, we need more students in college, and schools need to continue to be finding ways, we said it just a second ago, to create additional streams of revenue during this recession. Most black colleges, their entire endowments were caught up in the stock market, and so black colleges have found their endowments have plummeted by 20%, 30%, and 40%, and when they already had small endowments, it's dangerous. So we have to be creative, man.
Well, Sharon, I'm going to ask you to think about this question, then we're going to go to a break, and I'm going to come back to get your answer. What you would advise a young person to do who's coming out of high school now, who cannot afford from their own family's resources to pay for college, and who would be looking at anywhere from $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 indebtedness in order to go to college, and whether it's worth it for them to do that. But all of you, I want you to just hold on. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and continue this conversation in just a few moments.
I checked my list and she got everything that I need. Yes, indeed. So I think I lay some game on her mind.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We are back now with our Bloggers Roundtable. Joining us today, Sean King of the blog Sean in the City, Sharon Toomer, founder and managing editor of blackandbrownnews.com, and Anthony Bradley, who blogs at The Institute. Before the break, we were talking about the cost of going to college and whether it is worth it, considering what the expense is for people who have to take out loans that could tie them up financially for many, many years to go. Sharon, I asked you to think about what you would advise a young person to do looking at putting that kind of indebtedness on their back. What would you say?
I would extend this also to parents, Tony, that let's say your dream for your child is that you sent them away, you saved all your working years to create this nest for them to go, and they can't go. I just recommend that if that's the case, stay academically engaged. And you can do that by taking classes in a structured environment, whether it's a local community college, and then see what happens in years to come. But I would not suggest just completely staying out of the academic environment. So that would be my advice.
So there's a balance. So you don't want to stay out of the academic environment, and yet you don't want to put yourself $100,000, $120,000 in the hole either. Is that right? Or am I putting words
That's
in
your right. mind? And things could change in a couple of years. It's not etched in stone that you stay in that place. But if you take yourself out of the academic arena, more than likely you're not going to go back. So I just don't think it's healthy if you to just not be engaged at all. And what I mean is structured. So not one class, but several classes, if you can do that at a community level, community
Absolutely.
College level.
It's a tough situation.
It is.
Let's move on to another topic. Last night, of course, were the Academy Awards here in Los Angeles. A fairly predictable Slumdog took away the award for Best Picture. Kate Winslet, Best Actress for her role in The Reader. Two African-Americans were nominated this year in the Best Supporting Actress category, Viola Davis for her role in Doubt and Taraji Henson for The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. So Viola Davis was a favorite, actually, before the awards were announced for her performance as the mother of a boy who may have an inappropriate relationship with a priest.
My boy came to your school because they were going to kill him in a public school. His father don't like him. You come to your school, kids don't like him. One man is good to him, this priest. Then does a man have his reasons? Yes. Everybody does. You have your reasons, but do I ask the man why he's good to my son?
Well, Anthony, you know, African-American actors were on a roll there for a while. Halle Berry, Denzel, Jamie Foxx, Jennifer Hudson last year, but not this time.
No, not this time. And it probably just exposes the fact that for a lot of movie houses, I mean, they're simply making decisions about what kind of roles can be cast by people that will make us lots of money. And as the market changes in terms of the kinds of movies that people want to watch, it's certainly going to affect the kinds of actors that are chosen to play certain roles.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention the kind of movies that people want to watch. Sean King, the kind of movies that people wanted to watch over the weekend included Madea Goes to Jail, opened number one in the box office, $41.1 million. Not a movie you're likely to see ever considered for an Academy Award.
No, and I think that's a point worth making, is that while there are a lot of black films out there, nobody is really making a legitimate argument, and I'm not going to make it today because that would be hilarious that Tyler Perry or Madea Goes to Jail needs to be nominated for an Academy Award. But I think it does illustrate a point that, I mean, I was watching it with family and friends last night, watching the Oscars, and sort of kind of scratching our heads because there really were not a whole lot of quality roles out there for black men and women that were Oscar-worthy. And I'm not saying that there weren't some that could have been considered, but I think the issue is what types of roles are black folks still getting? But I think even this discussion may overshadow something that's really great. And a lot of people of color won great awards last night. Latino, Indian, people of all colors and hues and backgrounds and sexual persuasions were represented last night. And so black folk didn't win any awards last night, but there were still some great things that happened.
Absolutely. Did you watch it, Sharon?
I did. I did some of it, you know, going back and forth. Penelope Cruz, she's a Latina who won the award. Sean's right. There are a lot of people of color who did win in several categories. I don't know when Hollywood's going to get it. If the role doesn't specifically say for a black actor, then does that just discount your acting craft, your ability to, you know, Don Cheadle's a great actor who can be in anything. He
sure.
can play any role. So it speaks more to just this unwillingness to really broaden the opportunities for people of, or actors of color, period, or people of color in the business.
And I don't want to underplay at all the significance of winning an Academy Award. Obviously, it's a pinnacle in a lot of ways, but it seems as if black actors are really, you know, they really are trying hard to get that for validation of their careers. Do you see that, Anthony?
Absolutely. I mean, it's sort of the standard of approval, the final vetting that I've achieved some recognizable success in my vocation. It's also important to remember that the types of movies that win these awards are generally the types of movies that audience want to connect to in terms of looking at a person saying, could that be me? Or rather, I could see myself in that position or that role. And the fact of the matter is that the market's predominantly serviced by white Americans, and they pay to go watch movies so they can see people that look like and live like and act like them, or at least they pay to see movies that they can sort of somehow imagine themselves in those positions. And so to see an African-American in those in that spot is what would require some intellectual juggling to accept that. And I believe the movie producers know that.
Well, we'll have to wait and see what happens this time next year. Thank you all very much. Good reporters, bloggers roundtable today. That was Sean King of the blog Sean in the City. He joined us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Sharon Toomer, founder and managing editor of blackandbrownnews.com, joining us from WNYC in New York. And Anthony Bradley, who blogs at The Institute, he joined us from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis. We end the hour with the sounds of the soul of John Black. The group's lead singer, John Bigham, is right here live in studio.
Black John was a fighting man. Yeah. Black John was a fighting man. Listen now. Black John, fresh on the scene. Black John, mean machine. Black John, top dollar clean from some suspicious type of business making crazy green. You know he got into some trouble out there for shooting at him like they just don't care. Yeah, he took out about two or three and left a very special message. Don't you mess with me. Oh, oh. John let that pistol ring, and ain't nobody come up out of that thing. Heard the sound bounce back a couple of times before them boys even hit the ground.
My, my, that is the soul of John Black, combining funk, hip-hop, blues, rock, and whatever else seems right. John Bigham is the mastermind behind the group. You just heard him. He's released the third album under the Soul of John Black banner. It's called Black John, and that was the title cut, I'm presuming, John Bigham.
Yeah.
Black John, thank you and welcome to News and Notes.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you, man. I'm looking at you and I'm looking at the cover of this CD because, you know, you got these big sunglasses on here looking fierce and your music, actually, you look like your music sounds.
Oh, good.
On here. Yeah, this is a good thing. tell us a little bit about, this is confusing to me, okay? The Soul of John Black, Black John, John Bigham. All of those are you.
Yeah.
All right, so... But the Soul of Black John is the title of the CD.
The Soul of John Black.
The Soul of John Black
is the name of the band. Black John is the name of this particular CD. Black John is standing in front of a church, by the way. You know, so you know, it's just, you know, it's that thing, good and evil.
Oh, I got you. Mm-hmm. Now, you just sang the title song from mm-hmm. the new CD. One reviewer says about that, the lyrics are inconsequential. What matters is the soul and funk. I don't know if I agree with that. You agree with that?
You know what? I feel like I may have been taken out of context because I said that about one song on this record called Emotions. I said on that song, you know, I mean, you don't really need the lyrics. But to put that on the whole album, no, I don't agree with that. Yeah.
Well,
I
mean,
I put a lot of time into it.
Now, you've played with a lot of different folks. You were with Fishbone. You were a member of Miles Davis's band. Mm-hmm. When was that?
I was with Miles Davis. I started working with him in 87 as a writer, you know. Kind of, I was like a protege. And I just kind of ended up in the band, you know, just because I was around, you know. I was working with him writing music, and I just ended up playing with him. It sounds casual.
I mean, it was Miles Davis. You did write a song on the Amandla album.
Yeah, I wrote a song on the Amandla album, and he used to perform a couple other songs that I wrote live.
Yeah.
But that was the one that, you know, through all the red tape, yeah, I actually made it to the record.
So from an audience standpoint, Miles Davis, it was crazy to see him in the 80s, you know, back to the audience, head down, blow a couple of notes, walk off stage for a half hour, come back. What was it like working with him during that time?
Well, during the 80s, I think he was past that. I think it was more like that in the 60s. In the 80s, he was very open. I mean, he was a good friend to me. I spent a lot of personal time with him, you know, at his house and just chatting, and he would paint, you know, and we would just hang out, man. I spent a lot of quality time with him, you know.
You also are into blues, obviously. Mm-hmm. The Good Girl Blues, that was the last CD.
Yeah, that was the last CD
put out. Do you think of yourself as a pure blues person?
No, I don't think of myself as a pure blues person at all, but I am from Chicago. And I grew up listening to, you know, Bobby Blue Bland and Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and stuff like that, and hearing about it, you know, secondhand from my parents, you know. And even you know, later on in life, I realized that one of my brothers was quoting Howlin' Wolf all the time. And I didn't realize until after I listened to Howlin' Wolf that, you know, I was actually being fed that stuff, you know, all the time.
We're going to ask you to play another song for us in just a second. But before I do that, I wanted to ask you this, because as I listened to the whole CD, man, it's got some of everything in here. It's got a little blues, a little funk, a little hip-hop. And when I say it's all over the place, I mean that in a good way, uh-huh. You know, by uh-huh. design, I'm yeah. imagining, huh?
Yeah, I kind of did it like, you know, it's more like a DJ, you know, or like a live show. That's my set for the night, you know. And it's not that it's not cohesive, or, you know, that it doesn't, you know, go together. It's just that, you know, these, you know, each song kind of like has its own personality, but it all, you know, fits together.
Man, I say you're a lefty too, huh?
Mm-hmm.
All yeah. right, so what are you going to play for us?
Oh, sheesh, I'll play a little bit of I Knew a Lady.
Okay, I knew a lady too.
I'm sure you did. I knew a lady, and she was fine. She had a pretty face and a troubled mind. All she wanted was a little fun. She got dancing feet. She wanna get it on. All the law children need to be saved. All the law children lost in these days. All the law children in the frying pan. Good God Almighty, throw up your dang hands. All the law children out in these streets. All the law children fighting for peace. All the law children up off your knees. Good God Almighty, come and dance with me. All. 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 All the law children feeling the pain. All the law children trying to maintain. All the law children trying to kill the brain with two Vicodin and a glass of champagne. Don't do it. It ain't gonna work. All she wanted was a little fun. She got dancing feet. She wanna get it on.
I like that. Yeah, that's
a little Hollywood story.
Yeah, well, you know, this is great. So tell me a little bit about the band.
Oh, the band is it's kind of a little community that we have going on. Just me and a bunch of my friends who I've played with in different bands over the years. You know, we just became friends. And I play with them in whatever projects they got going on, you know, whether it's paying or not paying, and they do the same favor for me. You know, we just try to keep it going, you know, and work with each other, you know, from Adam McDougall, who plays keyboards. He plays with the Black Crowes, we played together with Nika Costa, the bass player Sean Davis. We played with Nika Costa together, but he also plays with Beck and, you know, so on and so forth. A lot of local guys who are just really good at what they do, and we just happen to be friends.
Well, you know, our time is up, and I appreciate mm-hmm. your coming on. I wanted to talk to you about Betty Jean, because I know that's a song you wrote for Miles Davis's.
Betty Davis.
Well, I tell you what, can you give me 30 seconds of it?
Oh, yeah. Them Betty Sweeney, them money.
She dipped in chocolate and 3 counts of honey. I checked my list and she got everything that I need. Yes, indeed. And I'm sweet on Betty Jane. Oh.
Thank you so much,
You're
man.
You're welcome.
Sweet on Betty Jane. This is John Bigham in studio with us. We do appreciate you coming by. Good
Thank
luck
you.
With the CD.
Thank you, Tony.
John Bigham is the mastermind behind the group The Soul of John Black. Their brand new CD is called Black John. That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.